Welcome to the West Side Conservatives.
Now, if you know politicians, they like to take pretty much credit for everything. I don't want to take all the credit for the rain, all right? But I am wearing my corn tie today, and that may have something to do with it. We've enjoyed the last couple of days. We started out in Council Bluffs, and we've been all over. We got up to Clear Lake, you know, the airport where Buddy Holly died, and people were offering me plane rides and offering to take me. And I don't know what exactly to take from that. You know, there was a dense fog where you could barely see your hand, and they're like, would you like to go for a plane ride? So, well, we came by car, so we've done a lot of driving. We've seen a lot of corn, and we saw that a lot of the corn was parched, so I think the corn's going to like a nice drink of water this morning. There was a little girl, you may have heard about her. She wanted $100, so she wrote a letter to God. She said, dear God, please send me $100. I'll do good things with it. Well, the postmaster thought it was cute, but he didn't know what to do, but so he sent it to the president. The president said, oh, that's nice, and he said to his secretary, send her $5. That, you know, she'll think that's a lot of money. She got the money, and she was a little underwhelmed. It's like $5. But her parents told her, always write a thank you. So she wrote a thank you. She said, dear God, thanks for the money, but next time don't send it through Washington. They stole 95%. I could probably just stop there. That essentially is the moral of what we as conservatives believe, that the more locally spent the money, the better. And it's not that we don't believe in any government. We get accused all the time of, oh, you're for no government. And so I'll sometimes laughingly say, no, I'm for $3 trillion worth. I'm for what comes in. That you spend the money that comes in, but you can't spend money that doesn't come in. And if people come to me and they say, well, we really like this program, I say, that's fine. You tell me what program to cut. If we're spending what comes in, it isn't so bad. There still is an argument that government should be more at the local level, even if you're spending what comes in, that we should have the smallest possible government we can have. Why do you want to have a small government? Well, I tell people it's not that government's inherently stupid, although it's a debatable point. It's that they don't get the same signals. If you're in business, if you're in farming, or you have a small business or a large business, you get signals sent to you on a daily basis, on a monthly basis, when you make your payroll, when you have to make a profit, when you got to pay the interest to the bank. You're being told whether or not you're doing a good job. You're constantly trying to please other people, the people who buy your stuff. They talk about capitalism as democratic capitalism. Everybody's voting every day with their money where they're going to buy their stuff. And so you're constantly getting these signals. And it's an amazing system. Because if you ever think about, well, how did you get your clothes? Where did they come from? Who made them? How did you get a pencil? There was a, Leonard Reed was an economist many years ago, and he wrote a little pamphlet called iPencil. And just to show all the little parts of a pencil and where it came from and how it got made. And if you had a central planner, you had the government do it, it would never get done. And so the beauty of the marketplace is through voluntary interaction, all of this gets done. But government doesn't do a very good job of it. So we should always minimize what government does. I tell people there are sort of two arguments for why you should minimize government. One is the liberty argument, and the other one is the efficiency argument. The liberty argument is what Thomas Paine advanced. He said that government is a necessary evil. And you say, well, gosh, that's pretty harsh, saying government's evil, particularly since I'm part of it now. I certainly can't be all evil. But he said government's a necessary evil because you have to give up a part of your freedom, a part of your labor, through your taxes to pay for your government. And that's not an argument against government or against paying taxes. It's just an argument for minimizing it. You're giving up part of your labor. You're giving up part of your liberty. So you should want to minimize what you have to give to government. But the other argument is pretty powerful also, and this is the efficiency argument. This is what Milton Friedman said. He said that nobody spends somebody else's money as wisely as your own. Think about it. If I ask you for $1,000 this morning, which we're not going to ask them, Kim, for money yet, are we? If I ask you for $1,000 for an investment, and I said, invest in my business, you'd go home, you'd talk with your spouse, and you'd think long and hard before you gave me $1,000. But if you're the government, and it's $1,000, or $1,000,000, or $1,000,000,000, or $1 trillion, do you think politicians lay awake at night and roll around thinking about how they're going to pay it back? No, that's the problem with government, is nobody cares about it. It's not their money. And also the amounts of the money are mind-boggling. You think about, what is $1 trillion? Anybody in here have $1 trillion? What is $1 trillion? We can't even conceive of $1 million, most of us. If you take $1,000 bills, stack in your hand 4 inches high, that's $1 million. If you want to take $1,000 bills and make $1 trillion, it's 63 miles high. 63 miles of $1,000 bills will get you to $1 trillion. And we are now $17.5 trillion in the hole. We started out, and some of this was our fault, frankly, we started out $10 trillion in the hole when President Obama was elected. We're at 17.5 now. We may well get to 20 by the time he's gone, which can't be soon enough as far as I'm concerned. But he will have doubled the national debt. And what does it mean? Is it just an empty number? Is the debt just meaningless because it's so extraordinary we can't fathom it? No, many economists say it's 1 million jobs a year being lost. It's this loss of growth that is unfortunate. You know, we can't do anything. Even the stuff we want government to do, government doesn't have enough money to do. Build roads, replace roads, build schools. We don't have enough money because there's this absence of growth. The first quarter of this year, it was actually negative again. I guess that was still Bush's fault. President Obama still thinks everything is Bush's fault 6 years later. I wonder when he's going to finally step up and say, hey, maybe I have something to do with the reason the government's not growing. One of the things that bothers me most about him is sort of this arrogance of thinking that, well, gosh, he's frustrated that he can't get anything done, so he'll just do it. He said the other day, I have no choice but to act. What does that mean? Does that mean he's just, because it's difficult in a democracy to convince other people to pass stuff, it's difficult because the Republicans control the House, and because there's 40-some-odd of us in the Senate, and we can filibuster things, because it's hard, he says, I have no choice but to act. So he's just going to create his own law. This, to me, is one of the probably, you know, there's a lot of things we disagree with the president on, but this is probably the most important thing because it goes at the fabric of the republic. The checks and balances, the separation of powers, is what kept us on a steady keel for 200 and some odd years. And he just thinks, I have no choice, so I will act. I have a pen. I have a phone. I will act. And so basically, it sounds more like a king. It sounds more like he's going to give royal edicts. And what does that do? It creates a whole host of unintended consequences. Right now, you have 50,000 kids at the border. They've come across. They just come across in plain sight and say, hey, we're here. Why did you come? The president said we were welcome. Anybody can come. In fact, they're handing out leaflets in Central America saying, if you get here by August 15th, the president won't send you home. Or saying that because the president has done this thing for the DREAM Act kids, that you're welcome. Now, not all of it's true. The DREAM Act apparently was limited, but he did it by edict. He didn't pass it through Congress. And my point is I actually have an open mind with regard to immigration, but you can't do it without securing the border. That's what conservatives who are for some form of reform have been saying. You can't do it without first securing the border, because then you open up and send a signal to everybody, hey, guys, anybody wants to come can come, because we have an open border. Milton Friedman also talked about this. He says you can't have open borders in a welfare state. You can't have a lot of free stuff and say everybody can come. Pew Research did a poll on this not too long ago, and they polled like 30 countries, and they estimated that 700 million people would come if they could. So, I mean, that's a great thing that we have a great country that so many people want to come, and I'm all for immigration. I'm not against immigration. In my state, and I don't know if it's true here, but in my state, many farmers use migrant workers. I think we need a robust work visa program. In fact, I think there's a place for a lot of people in this work visa program. I think that we need high-tech workers. You go to Silicon Valley and all these places, or even in Iowa where they have tech centers. We were in a tech center earlier this week. They're looking for people with PhDs and advanced degrees, computer programmers. We need those people. So there is some immigration reform that Republicans, frankly, should be for. But it can't be done by edict. It can't be done by royal or imperial edict by the president, because it creates havoc, and that's what we've got now, is havoc on the border. This happens in other areas, too. The president decided, he and Hillary, I think they call it Hillary's war, they went to war in Libya. They thought it would be, you know, just, we have such might, let's use it. And they wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. He's a bad guy. But what replaced Gaddafi? It's a jihadist wonderland. There's jihadist groups running all over the place. There's 15,000 man pads missing. The shoulder-fired missiles that can bring down planes and helicopters, 15,000 of them missing. There's more al-Qaeda and you name it, radical fundamentalist jihadist groups roaming Libya than ever before. In fact, we left the other day. So the situation is so unstable in Libya that our embassy fled to Tunisia. But the one of the main problems I have with this is the unintended consequences, but he didn't do it in a constitutional fashion. We don't go to war unless Congress passes war. This is what the Constitution said. In fact, James Madison said it very clearly. He said that the executive branch is the branch most prone to war. Therefore, with studied care, the Constitution gave that power to the legislature. Reagan agreed with this doctrine. There was the Reagan Doctrine for War that Caspar Weinberger wrote up, and he said that when we go to war, there should be a consensus of the people. There have been times when we've been almost entirely unified. When we were attacked December 7th, 1941, we were entirely unified as a country. We came the next day and voted on declaring war. And I think the vote had one objection. When we were attacked on 9/11, we were almost entirely unified. And I don't know if there was a vote against 9/11 either, but we voted. You voted through your representatives. This is the way you go to war if you have to go to war. War's the last resort, not the first resort. But if you let the president do it without any checks and balances, it can be done too often without the will of the people. The president came forward after Libya and said, let's get involved in Syria. And so I'm on the Foreign Relations Committee, and I raised my hand and I said, well, what if some of those weapons ultimately are used against us or against Israel? And everybody's like, oh, no, we have to go, and we're going to give the weapons to the moderate Islamic rebels. I said, do you speak Arabic? How are you going to figure out who are the moderate ones and who are the ones that want to cut people's heads off? So one of our senators was there with his arms around two of them, and apparently there are allegations now that one of them was involved with kidnapping and killing a Christian bishop, and another one was involved with this new group, ISIS. Now everybody's saying, well, ISIS, we must do something. We have to be involved in Iraq to do something about ISIS. Well, how did ISIS get so strong? Because we're arming the Islamic rebels, maybe not them directly, but we created a safe haven for them by beating back Assad. Who is the number one military opponent of ISIS right now? Assad. He's the one bombing ISIS's camp. Who else is the second most strong opponent of ISIS? Iran. But what happened when they attacked Mosul? They ran. The Iraqis ran. And so people are saying, well, we need to get back in there. And it's like, do you really want to send our sons and daughters to fight for Mosul when the Iraqis won't fight for Mosul? I can't do that. I look at things in very personal terms. I look at it as if I have three boys. Am I willing to send one of my sons to fight for Mosul? I just don't think, frankly, if they won't fight for it, we can't. You know, but will I support the government, Maliki? Yeah, there are ways we can support them to try to keep ISIS from growing, and we can monitor the situation to see what happens with ISIS. But we ought to remember how ISIS got created, and that maybe some of it was because we created a safe haven for them in Syria. When we move forward and we say, well, what are Republicans going to be for? What are we going to be for that's different than the Democrats? There's a big debate in our country, because I don't have to remind you, we lost in Iowa the last two presidential elections. So it isn't just about who you pick to represent you in your primary, ultimately, for the presidency. It's also about, how are we going to win? You're a purple state. If we can't win Iowa, we can't win the country anymore. And many have said this, and this is probably true. If Joni Ernst wins here in Iowa, we probably win the Senate, because Iowa's a tough state. So that's an encouragement to you and a little bit of an admonishment. We got to do better. But the debate is, how do we do better? How do we get big enough to win again? And some in the National Party would say, well, we just need to dilute our message. We need to be Democrat light. We need to be more moderate. If we can be just like the Democrats, but just a little bit different, then we'll beat them. Then we'll get people to come. I couldn't disagree more. I think that we need to be bigger, better, bolder. The stuff that we believe in, let's present it more boldly. We have Republicans, and in fact, some of our presidential candidates in the past have said, oh, well, we're for revenue-neutral tax reform. Anybody here want to hop out of their seat and go knock on a door for a candidate who's for revenue-neutral tax reform? That just means one of you is going to pay more taxes and one of you is going to pay less taxes. Could the tax code be simpler? Yes. But really, why don't we be what we used to be for? Let's be for lowering taxes to stimulate the economy. When Reagan dramatically lowered taxes, we had enormous growth. We had growth of 7% in 1 year under Reagan. 20 million jobs were created. We lowered taxes on everybody. But we can't let the other side say, well, oh, you're going to lower taxes on rich people. Give it up. Rich people pay a lot of taxes. If you say you're only going to cut taxes on the lower middle class, the tax cut's going to be this big because most of the income tax is paid by the people at the top. So when you lower taxes, you got to lower them on everybody. But instead of talking about taxes as, well, Mr. Jones will get a tax cut, why don't we talk about how much will be left in Iowa? Why don't we talk about how much will be left in Kentucky? Why don't we talk about how a city like Detroit with 20% unemployment and vast amounts of empty property, why don't we talk about how $1.3 billion could be left in Detroit, not brought in from anywhere else, just left there? So I have a plan called Economic Freedom Zones. We need to show that we are the party of compassion. We are the party that cares about people in Detroit who live in poverty or people in Iowa who live in poverty. And that for 50 years, the Democrats have sort of monopolized and said, hey, we care more. But hey, what about the policies? Doesn't it matter whether the policies work? We have the first African-American president, and yet black unemployment is still twice white unemployment. I don't accuse him of not caring. I think he does care. But I would say maybe his policies aren't working, and then maybe the Democrat policies. But we have to have a clear distinction. We can't become Democrat light. We have to have a clear distinction of what we're for. Let's be the small government party, the constitutional party, the party of the Bill of Rights, the party of lower taxes, and the party of less regulation. If we are, I think we'll have a clear distinction. Is that enough to win? Probably not. If you go to your universities here and you want to talk to kids who are 18, 19, 20 years old, and you say, all right, kids, we're for the balanced budget amendment. Kids don't care. We're for low taxes. Kids don't care. They don't have any money. They don't have any regulations. They got student debt, and they've got a cell phone. That's it. And and they care about both of those passionately. But the thing is, let's be for all the things. They're not refusing to join our party because we're the balanced budget party. They're just refusing because we're not engaging them where they are. Every kid's got a cell phone. But you know what? To a person, almost every one of them believes that the government shouldn't look at their records, shouldn't look at what they read, shouldn't listen to their phone calls without a warrant. If we're the party of privacy, we will grow, and it's a whole new area. And the Democrats, frankly, and the president, and Hillary Clinton, haven't been very good on these issues. This is the Fourth Amendment we're talking about. Everybody in this room is probably pro-Second Amendment. But if you want to protect the Second Amendment, you got to believe in the Fourth Amendment. This was a big deal to our founding fathers. Our founding fathers wrote the Fourth Amendment, and John Adams said that it was a spark that fired the revolution because the British were writing what were called writs of assistance. These were generalized warrants. No name was on them. The soldiers wrote them, and the British soldiers could come in any house they wanted. Why? Because they wanted to check. They were trying to see if you stamped your papers and you paid your tax. But we were really offended by that. So we wrote the Fourth Amendment. We said you have to have your name on the warrant. You have to say what you're looking for, and there has to be probable cause. And we separated it from the police. Even though some of my best friends are policemen or FBI agents, we didn't let the police write the warrant because they're in hot pursuit and their emotions run high. They have to call on the phone someone who's sitting, who you've elected that's supposed to be wise and rational and reasonable, a judge, and they get a warrant. But most time they do, but it's a check and balance. If there's a potential rape or a murder here in town, and you want to go in someone's house, the police will call from the curb and get a warrant. It's almost never turned down. But it's that check and balance between police and the judiciary that give us our freedom and protect our freedom from abuse. If we're the party of the Fourth Amendment, I think we grow our party because we bring in a whole host of new people that aren't already Republicans, that are also primarily young. But some of them are independents as well. That's how we grow the party. We also have to become a more diverse party. We need to be a more welcoming party. We can't be the party. We have to have the right policy on immigration, but we can't be the party that appears not to like people because they're immigrants. Everybody in here was an immigrant 100 years ago, probably. Your grandparents, great-grandparents were. We need to be the party that welcomes people to our country, needs to be done legally, but we can't be the party of hostility towards people who don't necessarily look like us, who have a different background. We need to welcome people to our country and be a welcoming party. Has to be done lawfully. The policy is important, but so is the attitude. It's the same way with the African-American population. We need to welcome people into our party. We need to be the people who will go to the Urban League and NAACP and Detroit and say, we want your vote. If we do that, we can win again. All of those states that we don't win, we can win again if we are a more welcoming party. And finally, I would say the way we win is you have to do it with a smile on your face. You have to do it with an optimism. You have to do it with a clarity. You have to believe in something that attracts people to the party. I think of the painter Robert Henrein, who said, paint like a man coming over the hill singing. And I like the image of that. I think when we become the party that proclaims our message, the passion of the Bill of Rights, like Patrick Henry, but also proclaims our message like a man coming over the hill singing, then I think we'll be the dominant party again. Thank you very much. And we'll be happy to do some question and answer, I'm told, as long as they're easy questions. Water. I think I saw over here, yes.
You went to Berkeley, what, last week?
About a month or so ago, yes.
And how did that go? That kind of address was going to where we believe we would not be welcome.
Right. Berkeley's not an easy crowd. Not known for being very conservative. And so I took the message, basically the Fourth Amendment. But here's the interesting thing. The speech I gave was almost identical to a speech I gave 2 weeks before at the Conservative Political Action Committee. So it's not like I just sort of said, oh, I'm going to say one thing here and one thing there. But I brought the message to a bunch of young people about privacy and their cell phone and the whole idea of due process and that these are our rights. The other thing I frankly often say, not only at Berkeley, but will say, at the Urban League, is that the Bill of Rights isn't so much for people who are popular. The Bill of Rights is for people who are minorities, but also people who are unpopular ideas, people who might be homeschoolers, people might be evangelical Christians that aren't the majority necessarily, but have ideas that they believe strongly in. So I think, and I tell people, look, you can be a minority because of the color of your skin or the shade of your ideology. But it resonated at Berkeley the same way it resonated at CPAC. That is ultimately the answer, is not giving up on what we believe in, but finding aspects of what we believe in and trying to say, come and join our party because this is why we will defend your rights. We have always been the party, really, of the Bill of Rights, voting rights and civil rights, but it got lost somewhere. We need to talk more about it. There was a bill passed in 2011 that allows for an American citizen to be indefinitely detained. And I was horrified by this. The president signed it, and he said, oh, I'm a good man, I'll never use it. That's not what laws are about. It's about the, you know, Madison said, it's not, if everybody in government were angels, we wouldn't have to worry about the law. And I'm not even so much saying President Obama's a bad person. I'm saying, what if the next guy is even worse, or the next woman? That's why we have laws. The laws are to restrain the government. But that passed. But when you think about it, if you're any kind of minority, you need to be more worried. If your ideas are at all not whatever everybody else thinks, and you want to have your own ideas, and you're worried about that nonconformity being a problem. So one of the other senators said, well, it's no big deal. We're only going to lock up people who are dangerous. I said, sort of begs the question. Who gets to determine who's dangerous and who's not? That's what a trial's about. That's why you get a lawyer. That's why you get due process. And it's the very definition of tyrannical government is arbitrariness. And you can't allow things to be arbitrary. One of the examples I'll often use is, anybody remember Richard Jewell? Richard Jewell was said to be the Olympic bomber. He was convicted on TV within hours. He fit the profile. He had a backpack on. He was kind of an introvert. And he tried to help, and sometimes I think bombers try to help afterwards. Turns out he wasn't the bomber. They did finally catch the bomber, but they convicted him within 4 hours. And I tell people, think about it, if he'd have been a black man in 1920 in the South, when we weren't doing a very good job with due process, what would have happened to him? Vigilante justice. And so we need to be the party, we always have been the party of the rule of law, and we talk about it all the time, but let's be the party of the rule of law on everything. The war on drugs is another example. 3 out of 4 people in prison are black or brown. You say, well, they're using drugs a lot. So are white kids. What's happening is poorer kids in the big cities are easier to find and arrest. They don't get as good of attorneys. I also don't think we should lock people up for 15 and 20 years. Do I think drugs are bad? Absolutely. And so I really think any kind of use of illegal drugs is wrong. But at the same time, if kids make a mistake, I don't want to put them in jail for 10 years, 15 years. And you say, gosh, that's a liberal idea. I remember an interview 10 years ago had Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Cal Thomas, not your most liberal people. And they ask each one of them, if someone in your church were caught with drugs, what would you rather, incarceration or counseling? Every one of these Christian conservatives said counseling. Still, some people are going to have to be punished more severely, but for goodness sakes, let's try to get people back into employment, get them away from drugs. Let's try to get them back the right to vote. So there are things that we can. I know that's been an issue in Iowa, it's an issue in Kentucky. But I have a friend who 30 years ago, it's a friend's friend actually, 30 years ago had marijuana plants in a college dorm room, got a felony conviction, still can't vote. He's married, he's got kids, it's 30 years later. I mean, most of us are Christians, we believe in redemption. Certainly don't we believe in, you know, that the law should give you a second chance. Now, I'm not talking about violent people. Violent people need to be separated from us. That's why we put them in prison. But nonviolent people, I think, deserve a second chance, and we want to give them a chance to get back employed. Anybody else? Yes.
Senator, thanks for coming here. I've got five grandchildren. I'm very concerned about the national debt we're passing on to them. A few years ago, the president commissioned the Simpson-Bowles thing. As near as I could tell, that's gathering dust somewhere on a shelf. Whatever became of that.
Completely ignored, like the Grace Commission from 20 years before. One of the big things from the Bowles-Simpson was that to fix Social Security and fix Medicare, we need to gradually raise the age. It's really not as hard as you would think. It doesn't affect retired people. Retired people are already retired, and they're already on Social Security and Medicare. It's my generation. But if you start doing that for my generation and on down, you can fix. That's two-thirds of the Social Security problem you fix if you raise the age to 70. You don't do it for people who are 69 and can't make plans. You do it for people who are 50 and 55 and on down. That fixes two-thirds of the problem. But here's the thing is, the president says, I'll talk to you about entitlements if you'll raise taxes another $1 trillion. And it's like, oh, you want us to sabotage the economy, ruin the economy, and raise unemployment so you'll do what's right and what you just should do because it's broken? And here's the problem. You need politicians or legislators or people who run for office who are brave enough to say that. We should raise the age. I said it, frankly, in Kentucky, and they said, you can't be elected if you say you're going to raise the age of Social Security. And I said, well, maybe people are ready for someone who actually do the right thing rather than what's the political thing to do. But here's how difficult it is. We had a vote about 4 months in Congress, and this vote was Twiggy the water skiing squirrel, which is a fascinating video if you want to watch it. But Twiggy the water skiing squirrel, will you pay $3 million for Twiggy the water skiing squirrel to promote the sale of American walnuts in Spain? And God love you, if you've got a walnut farm, good for you, but I'm not interested in selling them for you. The government shouldn't sell your walnuts, you know? So we have a $3 million program. We tried to cut it. We lost. We couldn't cut $3 million from a program that really is not essential to the basic function of government. And when you have a $1 trillion deficit, should be one of the easiest things to cut. Over half the Republicans voted to keep it, and almost all the Democrats did. But how I relate this to Social Security and entitlements is, if you can't cut Twiggy the squirrel, how are you ever going to raise the age on Social Security? But I think it might be going the opposite way. If you ever got someone who ran for office who was honest enough just to say something that might not be immediately popular, that we should raise the age of Social Security and Medicare gradually, a couple of months a year. Reagan did it in 1983. We changed. A lot of people don't even realize this now. If you're getting ready to retire, you probably do. But we raised it from 65 to 67, about a month or two. And I think it's right about at 67 now, but it took 20, 30 years to get there. You do that again. You do it over 20, 30 years, raise the age to 70, fixes a lot of the problems. And people say, well, that's heartless. Well, say, no, that's the compassionate thing because I'm trying to save Social Security. You try to save Medicare, but Social Security is $6 trillion in the hole and Medicare is $35 to $40 trillion in the hole. The thing that lacks compassion is to do nothing. And that's what's going on now. Everybody just, oh, well, you know, we'll see what happens.
The 2016 isn't that far off. The worst thing you can do in politics is let your opposition define you. And I think the Republicans would really be well advised to get out front, have a contract, have a Contract for America, that type of thing. Because the mainstream media is not going to cut you any favors because they're in the back pocket of the administration. And the other side of my question is, I'm not going to ask you whether you're going to run for 2016, but do you have 50 different ties?
By coincidence, I have a corn tie, and by coincidence, I have one in the shape of South Carolina. I don't know why, but a lot of people hearken back to the contract with America. We made it clear, succinct, we made a national message, and it did help. For congressional candidates, it's sometimes hard to get enough money to get your message attached to your name, but we attached it for everybody, and we ran on a very popular sort of 10 planks with the contract with America. It's a great idea. Not only do we need to attach ideas to our name, we need to have sort of a, I tell people, it's kind of like Domino's. Domino's a couple years ago said, you know what, our pizza crust is the pits. It's not very good. And they admitted it on a commercial and said, we're going to do better. Republican Party kind of has to, we kind of need a new GOP. We need not giving up the best parts of what we are, but we need to put a better face forward. Because, frankly, our problem with getting new voters is not the policy. I'm not promoting that we change most. I mean, a lot of our policy, I think, is the correct policy, you know, for poverty, for unemployment. But if people don't think about that you care about them, they are never going to listen to your policy solutions. So we have to go places we haven't been going. We have to show up in Detroit. We now have opened, the RNC has opened an office in Detroit. I was there for the opening. We need offices in all the big cities. We are winning the countryside. We just aren't winning the big cities. So to win big cities, though, people have to listen to you. To listen to your policy, they have to see you showing up at venues you haven't been showing up, and you have to have something to say once you're there. But I think Reince Priebus, who is the chairman of the RNC, understands that. I've seen him in a lot of the places saying the same thing I'm saying. We have to have a bigger party. Okay, the first part of that is, what do I think about the Iowa Core? This is part of Common Core. I'm not real excited about Common Core. I think that most things with curriculum should be developed locally. I'm sort of old-fashioned. Ronald Reagan wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. I still would. I'd get rid of it. Because I'm not sure anybody's any smarter since 1980 that our kids are doing better when compared on international testing. I'm not opposed to testing. In fact, when I was a kid, we took a national test. It was the California Achievement Test. But each state sort of looked around and they decided to do it. But now when you mandate it from above, everybody's like in Kentucky, we have our own testing. Then we take a national test and the government forces us to take another test. The kids are tested to death, I think, and not necessarily any smarter. Is some testing good? Yes. But I would let local people figure that out. I think if you want innovation, you need more freedom for the superintendent, the principal, the assistant principal, the teachers. I also think that we make a mistake as Republicans blaming teachers for everything, you know, because frankly, some of the fault, we need to look in the mirror. It's parents' fault as well. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Outliers, and they talk about the poverty gap. If you look in kindergarten or first grade and you test kids, poor kids test worse than middle class and rich kids. And it gets worse each year until about fifth grade. It just keeps getting worse over time as kids go to school. But if you look at it in September and May of each year, it gets narrower each year in school. It gets wider in the summer. All of the difference in poverty gap can be accounted from kindergarten to like fifth grade in the summer, not during school. So actually our schools aren't as bad as we think. It's we, the parents, aren't as good as we think. And if we don't understand that, we won't be able to fix the problem. But I think you need more innovation locally. And I don't like the idea of a national curriculum or Common Core, and I'm opposed to that. I was opposed to No Child Left Behind also, which is what Republicans did, which doubled the size of the Department of Education, spent much more money in Washington, had many more mandates on testing, and frankly judged whether a teacher was good or bad from Washington. Nobody in Washington has a clue whether your local teacher here is good or bad. It's a way for us to be actually on the side of teachers. Most teachers hated No Child Left Behind, but it was also federalization of the control. I think if we can be for more local control and tell teachers, frankly, nobody in Washington knows whether you're a good teacher or bad. Let's judge that locally, and still has to be judged. We need to improve our teachers. There's all kinds of great stuff going on in education. Has anybody ever seen Khan Academy? There's this guy named Salman Khan. He doesn't have a teaching certificate, but he's an engineer from MIT. He has like 2,000 YouTubes that are like a minute or two long, maybe 3 minutes long, on just different scientific things. Like I watched one the other day for one of my kids on the Doppler effect. It's the best explanation I've ever heard. And what you could do in education, if you wanted to transform education, is you could have extraordinary teachers anywhere in the world who would teach classes. You would still have the local teacher, but why not have the person who's the best person in the entire world to explain calculus explain it to your kids in your local high school? They'd do a lecture, and then your teacher would also then help them to try to understand. But there are extraordinary teachers. Let's pay them more. Let's let them teach millions of kids at a time. Let's let our teachers then learn from the extraordinary teachers the techniques. And you could transform education. Then let kids give them a choice on where they go to school. Let poor kids get a voucher. Let them go anywhere they want. All of a sudden, you'd have competition. You'd have much better schools. But I do it all more locally and not the federal level. Yes?
Senator, when we take control of the Senate, what is the caucus leadership in the House and the Senate? What are the first four or five things they're going to do next spring? You've spoken about Social Security. Address highlights in regard to health care, foreign policy, taxes. I mean, how can we hit the ground running and tell the country we're ready for change?
If I had to guess, one of the first things would be repealing Obamacare. However, I'll have to be a realist with you. If we get 51 votes in the U.S. Senate and we have a majority in the House, the House and the Senate will probably vote to repeal it. If I had to predict, I think he'll veto it. So I know that's a real shocker to you. However, I think we still will do it to show the people that that's what we're for. That being said, I think we will then try to see what he will sign. I think we'll send him another bill and another bill until we find things that he'll sign. Ultimately, there's going to be even more pent-up frustration with Obamacare when you see your bills. The bills are going to come due this fall, and the premiums, I believe, are going to go up for most people. I think we're also going to find that he gave insurance to a lot of people, subsidized their insurance, but he gave them subsidized insurance with a $6,000 deductible. If you can't buy your insurance, what are the odds you're going to pay your $6,000 deductible? Your local hospitals are going to find that people now think, well, I've got my insurance card, so they're going to go more often, but it's a $6,000 deductible, and I think they're going to find that they're still non-payers. The hospitals originally supported Obamacare thinking we would convert non-payers to payers. I think what's going to happen is we're going to convert non-payers to people who think they're going to pay, who show up, who still don't pay. And I think the hospitals are going to be hurt by this, and there's going to be a crisis. The other thing that's going to happen, and I don't know what you guys did with Medicaid here, but in Kentucky we expanded Medicaid by 50%. We went from 700,000 people to 1 million. Anybody ever had a 50% increase in the cost of their business in 1 year? That's a dramatic increase in cost, and it's going to be difficult for that to be absorbed by the working public. It's sort of what Phil Graham used to say. You keep loading people in the wagon, someone's got to pull the wagon. And you can get too many people in the wagon. There is a danger of that. Yes?
My question is twofold. One, with all the stuff coming towards the Internet, there always seems to be another bill attacking Internet freedom. Is it time for a constitutional amendment that actually protects that, for one? And twofold, with the college debt situation, nobody seems to be talking about the fact that, quite frankly, what banks are giving out loans that are virtually indentured servitude because you can't not pay that back. My sister, for one, went to a very good college, had some help, but she got the federal loans, and then she also had private loans. Well, those are two separate things, so now her loan payment is at a really, really tough point, and thank God she's got people to help her out. But what happens to all the people that don't help it out? Are we allowing banks to create a situation because of the way we have to have school, we have to have school, rather than reforming the system? I mean, how do you fix that without addressing the way these people are lending?
As far as Internet freedom, one of the great things that has happened to our country in the last 20 years, and really to the world, frankly, has been the hundreds of thousands of jobs created in a brand new industry that no one ever could have conceived of. One of the reasons it did is because it was brand new, it wasn't overburdened with regulations and taxes. So the Internet, if we can keep it free of taxes and free of regulations, is still one of the biggest engines of growth. You know, Apple Computer is one of the largest taxpayers in our country. and one of the largest employers as well. So yeah, we need to keep the internet free. On student loans and on the cost of education, it's not a simple issue trying to figure out exactly how you fix it. But I would ask you, when you think about it, what in our economy has prices that rise rapidly? Healthcare and education. What is the common denominator between the two? The government's heavily involved with subsidizing the demand for both. That's a good explanation, but then the answer you would have to think is government would have to subsidize them less if you don't want the price to rise so much. You can do top-down control, and you can mandate to universities they can't charge more or that they have to have less overhead. But once again, that's what we've tried in healthcare. You create a problem by subsidizing demand and getting government too involved, and then you bring government in on the top to try to push prices back down. It's just not a good situation. You can help a little bit with student loans, and I have sympathy, but you're right. If the student loans are $150,000 a year, and you thought you were going to make $75,000 a year, and you're going to make $30,000, paying it back, it's not a good deal. And some of it is we've also said to everybody that everybody should have a college degree. And frankly, we do need plumbers and pipe fitters and welders and carpenters. And those are good, honorable jobs. And to tell you the truth, sometimes, if you're good at them, pay more than a business degree or a general degree from a university. So we need to figure out and not overemphasize, and also maybe emphasize more some technical trades, going to community college, getting technical trades and technical schools. One thing we could do for the burden, and I'm working on a bill on this, for the burden of the debt, though, is to make it deductible. We allow you and your parents to have some deductions and credits versus tuition, but it's over a narrow period of time. I think you have to do it over the window of time you're in college. So if you're in college, you have no income to deduct it against. So let's say you have $100,000 in loans and you get out and you make $30,000 a year. I would let you deduct it maybe for over 10 or 20 years. So deduct $1,000 or $2,000 each year and treat college as a business expense. You're allowed to deduct your business expenses. You went to college to try to get into business or to get a job. Make it deductible over a longer period of time. Make maybe even the principal deductible, not just the interest, but maybe the principal. There are ways we could help it. I don't like what the Democrats want to do. The Democrats want to do is mandate to you, if you're a bank and a student came in and made a loan with you, we're going to mandate what the rate is after the fact. You know, that's sort of, if you destroy contracts, you destroy really the sort of the foundation of our country. That's why third world nations don't succeed, is because contracts won't be honored and your capital's not secure. The government at any point in time can come in and steal your business. And that's why people won't build in the third world, because your contract is not secure. So you have to be a little careful about saying, well, banks charged me 5% 4 years ago, and I'm just not going to pay that. You know, I made a bad decision one time. I bought a house and when I was in residency, and I paid 11% with premium mortgage insurance. I think I was at 12%. And then interest rates came down. I feel like, why did I do that? Why didn't I live in an apartment for a couple of years? My wife still tells me I made a bad decision on that. Let's do one or two more. Straight back. I'm in favor of the concept. I am in favor of traditional marriage, and really, you know, I think that's been the foundation of civilization for thousands of years. And the loss of the idea of marriage is really probably the leading cause of poverty in our country, in the sense that if you have kids before you're married, your chance of being in poverty is 3 or 4 times that of anyone else. As far as whether we should do it at the federal level or the state level, I don't want to register my guns in Washington or my marriage. And that may not please everybody, but historically our founding fathers didn't register their marriage in Washington. They registered it locally at the courthouse. I'd rather see it be a local issue, not a federal issue.
You talked about changing the face of the GOP and changing how other people perceive the GOP in particular. I'm a young conservative woman.
You know, some of it's been this sort of narrative that's come from the other side. So we talked earlier about letting the other side characterize you. For the past several years they've been characterizing us, somehow saying, you know, we're some troglodytes who really are against birth control. You know, there may be various opinions in here, but I think there's probably almost nobody in here who wants to ban birth control. I haven't heard any Republican politician who does. So they made it all about this. The Hobby Lobby case, it isn't about anything to do with government banning birth control. It's really about freedom of religion. And really wasn't even about birth control, because they provide like 15 different types of birth control and objected to a few. But it's really not about that. It's about whether a business should be able to choose what kind of insurance they buy. Because really, frankly, a business ought to be able to decide, what, you know, it's an expense, it's a cost, what kind of insurance. And that's the whole problem with Obamacare. Obamacare is all this coercion that comes in here and tells you what kind of insurance you can buy. How we change our perception? Need more women to run for office, so step up. We need you next time around. And we do. I mean, your candidate here is Joni Ernst. I was yesterday campaigning for Dr. Miller Meeks as well, who's a good candidate. So you have good women that are running. We need more of that, and we just need to keep telling the media and the Democrats, frankly, that they're being ridiculous about this. They concocted this whole thing in some Madison Avenue advertising agency that there's a war on women. And I kind of jokingly say, yeah, if there was, the women won. You know, I mean, I have three nieces, and in all of our family, the girls are doing at least as good or better than all the boys in the family. I see it in the schools. I see it in the friends of my kids. The girls are doing great. They're doing better in school. When they get out of school, statistics actually show that women actually are earning higher wages when you compare job to job, people getting out of school. It's like 8% higher. The White House, you know, does this little song and dance and game. They looked at all the White House salaries. Women were making less in the White House when you don't compare job to job. And so when you do false comparison, you can make up a narrative. But like my three nieces, two of them are going to medical school. Over half of their class is women. One of my nieces is at Cornell Vet School. 85% of her class are women. So, you know, are there still less women CEOs? Yes, but over time there are going to be more. In fact, my prediction is over the next 20 years, there's going to be more men staying home and more women working. And y'all can have it. I'll stay home with the kids. Thanks, everybody.